Thanks for tuning in. Host Noah Weil is a licensed attorney admitted to practice in Washington State and the Federal Court of the Western District of Washington. Some guests on this program may be licensed attorneys as well. However, the discussion on this podcast is intended to be informative only and is not a substitute for legal advice for your particular situation. The information may be right or may be wrong. Changing laws and the laws of individual states mean the information presented here may not be accurate. But regardless, and this part is important, neither Noah nor any guest here is your lawyer. If you need a lawyer for your individual situation, you should consult and retain your own attorney.
This week on the podcast, I'm joined by Justice Cheryl Gordon McLeod. Justice McLeod was elected to the Washington State Supreme Court in 2012, and since then she's made a bit of a name of herself for issuing opinions that respect the rights of criminal defendants in a way that I think a lot of courts around the country somewhat ignore. I'm a pretty big fan of Justice McLeod, and I'm really gratified and happy that she was willing to sit down and talk with me for a while. In fact, we talked for so long that I split this up into two parts. We had some really nice discussions about how the court works, the nature of the cases before them, common mistakes lawyers and judges make, and a lot of other stuff. It was a good talk. Stay tuned. I was going to make a joke about how you get to be a judge and you don't get a gavel, you have to be a justice, you know, you're not at the trial level. But, oh, it's not just that one. Look at that huge one on your bookcase there. That's crazy. Do you ever bring that down to the arguments and be like, all right, let's keep it contained, guys?
When I graduated from law school in 1984, my uncle, who was the only other lawyer in the family, in fact, one of the only other, real professionals of that in the extended family, sent a package, and it contained an enormous paperclip about 3 feet long, and the gavel, which is, what is that, about 2.5 feet high?
Some justice sledgehammer there, yeah.
So that's from my Uncle Sam, welcoming me to the profession.
That's nice. He had high aspirations for you, I think.
He did, and he didn't get to see me join the court. Yeah.
But I'm sure he's seen your experience and your career up to near the end, right?
Oh yeah.
Proud of it.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah.
So Justice McLeod, thank you again for joining me on this podcast.
Oh, happy to do it.
Can you start off for the listeners and just kind of talk about yourself, your introduction to the field, and what's led you to the highest court in the land?
It's a long road. I grew up in the late 60s and early 70s, and I remember all the turmoil of those times, and I remember whether I was at a game or a demonstration or in a class that one of the things I would say most often was, well, that's not fair. And I eventually took my love for standing up for fairness and pointing things out and went to law school. And in law school, I had such wonderful opportunities to work on women's rights issues, prisoners' rights issues, and other individual rights issues. And it eventually led me to joining the Public Defender's Office in Seattle, here in Washington, which was one of the best offices that had one of the best training programs in the country.
TDA. So,
TDA.
Yeah.
So I was really fortunate to be there in the mid-80s and to benefit from, getting thrown into the deep end and learning how to swim by having back-to-back trials and over again. And sometimes you win and sometimes you just finish.
I think that it's good for a defense attorney to be comfortable with losing. I don't like telling my clients that, but telling them, hey, or at least knowing, I'm experienced with losing. It's happened before. It'll happen again. as a defense attorney, I think that's a pretty common outcome.
Well, I think it's totally important and fair to be telling your clients, look, here's my evaluation of your case. These are the issues. These are the ones that I think are winnable. These are the ones that I think are not winnable. This is the offer that's on the table, if there's an offer on the table, and it's your decision.
Oh, absolutely.
How you want me to proceed. But I do remember that being willing to go to trial, if the client wanted to go to trial and it was their choice, was one of the most important things to me.
I love it when my clients say, no deals, we're going to trial no matter what, because I said, great, I don't have to bother with negotiating, I don't have to deal with all that stuff, we're just going to go forward and be aggressive, investigate fully, and present our case. And I never bring it up again, and everyone's happy. And even if they lose, they know that their lawyer had their back and supported them. I think it's really important. I think, especially when you're doing indigent defense, a lot of those people have not had experiences where, especially people that are paid by the government, have their back completely and are fully supportive. And giving that them experience is so important.
I think that's completely true. That was my experience as well. In fact, I remember one trial in federal court on an immigration matter. The jury came back. We lost. And my client turned to me and said, thank you. I really appreciate everything you've done for me. And I think it's so important for criminal defense lawyers to realize that how important their counsel and their support is for the client as well as their representation in court.
Yeah. And it's also fun to have a reputation of being willing to go to trial, because then better deals start trickling down because they know you're serious and you're going to put your money where your mouth is.
That was also my experience, that being willing to identify legal issues, file motions if that was called for, and follow through and go to trial if you said you were going to go to trial, is important for each individual client, but overall gives you a level of respect that people know that your word means something when you say it. Mm-hmm. When you say ready for trial, it means ready for trial. I agree with you. I think that's a really important lesson for people in private practice, and it's a really important lesson for people who take public defense cases.
So you did some work with TDA, and then what was your next step in your
path? I was a TDA for a few years in the late 80s, and I took some time off when I had my first son, and came back for a while. I had done misdemeanor trials, felony trials, and then came back and did appeals at TDA. And then I got involved in a large multi-defendant case that was being prosecuted by the state in King County. It was called the Clam Scam case at the time. And it was one of the first prosecutions in the state under the state's profiteering law, which is kind of our state's little RICO, little racketeering law. And we had some wonderful issues in that case, ranging from whether clients' property could be seized in advance of trial to deprive them of their ability to pay lawyers, and in that case the answer was clearly no, to what types of crimes could be prosecuted when defendants are suspected of stealing gooey duck clams from somebody else's field underneath Puget Sound. But from there, I stayed in private practice. I ended up hanging out my own shingle, initially doing some private cases and some appointed cases, and then was able to gravitate towards what I really loved, which was doing appeals. Federal court, state court, different levels of the state court, often before the Washington Supreme Court. So I'd been arguing in front of the court that I'm on for about 20 or 25 years before I decided to run.
Was it your idea always to come to the Supreme Court, or did someone kind of prod you and say you would be a good fit for this court?
It was never my idea to come to the Washington Supreme Court. It was my idea to go to law school. It was my idea to become a public defender. It was my idea to try to become a really good trial lawyer. And then it was my idea to try to become a really good appellate lawyer so that the cases that I worked on wouldn't have an effect in just one case, but would be able to affect other cases if they were published. And they did. And sometimes that was a positive thing, and sometimes that was not a positive thing. But I never had in the back of my mind being on the Washington Supreme Court until the time came when I had about 25 years of experience doing appellate work. A lot of it was in an area that other members of the Washington Supreme Court hadn't practiced in. Mm-hmm. That is criminal defense, private practice, and public defense, often taking cases from people who couldn't afford to hire a lawyer, and raising the constitutional issues that were present in so many of those cases, and winning a significant number of them, many because of the state's errors, because the state had failed to disclose to the defendant evidence that was really exculpatory, that really could have shown that he was innocent. And I felt that I had such an important perspective and had so much experience that I could bring to the court that when an opening occurred, I ran for it. I do want to answer the part of your question about whether somebody encouraged me. Mm-hmm. And I want to say that there were a couple of women on the Washington Supreme Court who did take the time to reach out to me and encourage me to run. And these were justices who never agreed with me on anything that I had brought to the court. Same with some Court of Appeals judges. But they were kind enough, professional enough, even-handed enough to say that they thought I'd be a good fit in the judiciary.
It took me years to realize that when judges start yelling at you from the bench, that it's kind of a sign of affection.
Uh-huh.
When I remember when I was doing public defense work and I was assigned to a specific courtroom in Seattle Municipal Court, judge, they were giving the business left and right, not handing things up correctly or not having, you know, documents in the right order or something like that, legal issues that weren't fleshed out, anything. And I just thought she couldn't stand me. And then afterwards when I left, you know, she just said, I'm really going to miss you. I really like the work you're doing. I really think you've got potential. And it was eye-opening to realize that she was trying to mold me. And it's maybe something similar when you're arguing in front of the Court of Appeals or the Washington Supreme Court. They're saying, you've got the chops, that you can handle this, and that you've got a place to keep rising to.
Well, I think what they were saying is what I would say now to a lawyer, which is when you come to the court, I want to have a conversation with you. I've read the briefs. I've done my homework. I've probably read the important parts of the transcript. I may have read more of the transcript than that. I want to ask you the tough questions, and I want to ask your opponent the tough questions, and I want to have a conversation about them. Now, if it's your first argument, I might tiptoe a little bit. If you're
guys know when it's someone's first?
Well, if I don't, I do because I know so many people in the appellate arena, and I know who's come before the court for the last several years that I've been on the court. So you don't know if it's somebody's first argument, but you might have a clue. Or it might be somebody's who's a recent graduate. And of course you're gonna, you know, you want people to have long and productive careers. So you might treat them gingerly at first. But when I have somebody who I know can answer the questions that I really have, I'm gonna start out by asking the questions. And the questions are a gift. The questions are, I may not be able to vote for you unless you can deal with this. Can you deal with it? And the answer should be, great, thank you for cluing me in.
Yeah, this is what the court cares about.
Yeah, thank you for cluing me in. Here's how I view it, and here's my homework. Here's the cites from the record. Here's the cites from the cases to answer your question. So I totally agree with you. When you think that somebody's giving you the, when you think that a judge is giving you the business or making you jump through the hoops, I think what the judge is doing is saying, help me out. This is my question. Can you help me out with this?
So you had some justices who liked what you were doing with the court. They liked the arguments you were making. You had been there enough times and they knew you were somebody who knew your stuff on a variety of issues, knew the record, etc. Some way to help facilitate your progress into the court.
Well, some of them endorsed me.
Yeah.
I mean, it's judges can endorse other judges in nonpartisan race, and some of them endorsed me, so it's not a secret. I was running for an open seat, and I think I was the first to file, so the three guys who filed against me were running against me.
Did you get the endorsements before filing?
No.
Okay.
No. Not necessarily the right way to do it. Somebody who'd been planning on being on the Washington Supreme Court for a long time might have done it very differently. Somebody who had that in their sights.
I mean, it worked out, clearly.
It worked out, but I was I learned that there was an open seat, and I moved from there.
So what does your family think about you becoming an elected official?
Well, my husband was so supportive, driving me places, baking cakes for me to bring to different events, putting up signs. My sons would go out talking to their friends, their classes. My older son went out onto the ferry boats and talked to people riding back and forth on the ferry boats and said, "You should vote for my mom." No, that was great. And the other thing that they gave me is something that I think most kids give to parents who are in public life, which is a sense of grounding. So it's like, I came back from this rally today and it went like this. Yeah, Mom, but do we have any milk? Okay.
It's nice thousands of strangers like you, but how about, you know, your family?
That's right, right.
Yeah. And now, when's the next election? You don't have to tell me if you're going to run again, but when is the next one?
I'm up in 2018, and I am going to run.
Okay.
I'm happy to tell you that.
We have a scoop. That's right.
This year is 2016. Mm-hmm. There's nine justices on the court. Three different justices are up every 2 years. So this year, Chief Justice Madsen, Justice Mary Yu, and Justice Charlie Wiggins are the three justices who will be on the, who are up for election. Each of them has challengers. I have endorsed in each of those races, and I've endorsed Chief Justice Madsen, Justice Wiggins, and Justice Yu. I'm up in 2018, mm-hmm. and when I'm up, so is Justice Gonzalez and Justice Owens. So by staggering them, obviously there's going to be longevity. Even no matter what happens at the election, there's going to be stability. And yet the people still have the opportunity to vote.
I've talked to other judges, and most of them can't stand the election process. They think it's the worst part about their job. They're usually 4-year terms. I guess I'm curious, your family's been so supportive so far. Is this something that you're looking forward to, having that kind of family binding moment again? Or is this just going to take away from the important work of the court that you have to raise donations or have your campaign raise donations and get out there and meet people instead of just being in here in your nice chambers working on your opinions?
Well, there's two parts to the question. One is, are judicial elections a good thing for the public, for the state as a whole? Mm-hmm. And the other is, are judicial elections a good thing for me?
Yeah.
On the more important question to your listeners, I'm sure, which is whether they're a good thing for the people of the state as a whole, I went into the election process thinking that the answer was no. The role of the judge is to uphold the Constitution. The Constitution protects individual constitutional rights against the tyranny of the majority. It seemed wrong to me that the majority would get to vote on the person who's going to be a judge, who's there to uphold the rights of the minority, as the Constitution directs us to do. But then I campaigned, and I realized that I got to talk to so many different types of people from so many different parts of the state, men and women, Democrats and Republicans, labor and management, you know, urban, rural, all different areas, young and old, that I realize that there's a real benefit out there to forcing me to be uncomfortable and listen to questions and get those tough questions and be out there showing the people that elected officials care and are willing to talk to them. I would go to so many different places where somebody would ask me one of the tough questions that seemed to come up regularly during my election, whether it was about guns or marriage equality, because that was on the ballot, or marijuana, because recreational marijuana was on the ballot. And we'd have a discussion, and then at the end of the discussion, they'd say, well, I don't know if I'd necessarily agree with you if you're going for the legislature or to vote on one of these things, but I sure appreciate you coming out here to talk to us. We've never had a statewide elected official come out here before. And it told me that there was a real importance to the process of elected officials being available to the people. So I think in terms of the people of the state, having elections has a lot of benefits.
I've got no problem with elections, and you know, I know our Constitution has basically everything is by election anyway. But I am also concerned with things like a judge role or a justice role where you're supposed to be impartial and you're supposed to be neutral. Having people who would be well suited for that role, a calm temperament, very studious, you know, whatever, who's maybe not very good around people. Maybe is unattractive, has a weird name, but would just be a great judge or justice. And because of the election process, and they have to have that appeal to the masses, that the state never gets the benefit of their wisdom because they will never get elected for whatever, you know, immutable reason that's central to them.
Well, I get that. And I certainly think that there's a variety of different attributes that you want in a judge that don't necessarily translate well to campaigning. But let's look at the alternatives. If you have appointment by the executive, the governor, he or she ran for office. He or she is having to make a decision based on what that will be responsive to the electorate that elected him or her. So vesting the decision in a different elected official doesn't necessarily address the problem that you're talking about. I think the big thing, I think the main thing that addresses the problem that you're talking about is educating people on how to vote for judges. Educating people that a judge is the person who you want to be fair, whether the litigants are rich, poor, black, white, male, female, whatever. You don't necessarily want the same things in a judge that you want in a legislator or a governor who's deciding on priorities based on how the people who've elected them want them to set their priorities. You want somebody who can listen to both sides, keep an open mind, be above the fray, and make a decision. And
do you think of your constituents as the people or as the law?
Well, the people who elected me are the people of the state, but I'm responsible for enforcing the Constitution, regardless of what the majority of the people in the state think is good policy at any particular time. Another distinction between me and your legislators or your governor: my job is not to decide what I think is proper policy for our state to choose with marijuana, with criminal sentencing, with a particular statute. My job is to interpret a statute that the legislature has written, decide if it is constitutional according to our state constitution and the U.S. Constitution. So it's a different job. I'm responsible for the Constitution, and I'm thrilled to be responsible for the Constitution. That's what I want.
I love all these answers because they just provide so many more questions.
Good.
I love your opinion. but just for one more question on the election thing, are you ever concerned that some candidate who may not be as adhering to the Constitution as you are, with such fealty and obvious reverence for it, maybe will do a lot of, you know, odd jobs driving Zambonis or whatever, and make a huge war chest and just be able to buy out all the advertisements and campaign dollars to basically smooth their way over to being elected?
Of course. It's an important concern, and you can look at judicial elections in the past as well as the current judicial elections, and you can see who's raising money from what sources and whether it's discontent over just a single opinion, and whether the ability to have so much money come in and influence the races really skews things.
It seems like a recent thing too. Maybe 10 years ago, no one cared about judicial elections at all. And then slowly the populace started caring, realizing how much power and influence the judges and justices have.
Well, yes and no. You know, on the national side, judicial appointments by the president have gotten a lot of publicity, some way before 10 years ago. And on the state side, although it's probably largely within the last 10 years since Chief Justice Alexander drew a challenger in around 2006, that we had the big concern about big money coming into the election. But, you know, I asked Chief Justice Alexander for counsel when I was running for my election, and when I was crying in my beer saying, oh, this is so hard, and he said, well, nobody's forcing you to do it. If you're going to do it, go out there and enjoy it. And I looked back at his campaign, and although he had tons of outside money coming in trying to defeat him and elect somebody else, he got out all across this state, campaigned, enjoyed it, really enjoyed meeting people, and even without that kind of a war chest, he won. So, yes, I'm concerned about it. Yes, I think that we need more education about judicial elections. Yes, I think that there's a danger when merit is playing less of a role. But the response that we've got to have, given the Washington State Constitution, is get out there and encourage friends of the judiciary and friends of the Constitution to educate people on voting for judges. So that means actually voting for judges, even though their names appear way down at the bottom of the ballot. Don't stop before you get to those names. Educate yourself. You can go to votingforjudges.org, probably, which has comparative lists of endorsements and qualifications for different candidates.
I've been to that website. It looks like a GeoCities or Angel Fire website from like 1998, but it does provide really, really useful information. And I wish there was some money in it so that I could, you know, be shined up a little bit and attract more people. But yeah, it's very useful.
Yeah.
Okay, one last question before we actually get to your job, which we should probably talk about at some point, what you do during the day. Our state constitution has a age limit of 75 for judges and justices. Do you think that should be changed?
I haven't given it that much thought, but I'm giving it more thought.
Every year or so, blow out some candles.
Right.
One more candle.
Look, I think there's a good reason that there was a cap on how long you could serve on the court. I think it's important for younger people to get experience. I think it's important for an older generation to step aside and for younger people to get in. I think it was plausible, probably at one time, for age 75 to be a presumptive age when you needed to step aside. In my experience, some people probably shouldn't be serving in their late 70s, but some people definitely should be serving in their late 70s and their early 80s. It's a bright line rule. Is there a benefit to a bright line rule? Yeah, it's easy. Is there a detriment to a bright line rule? Especially as times change over 100 years, longevity changes, and people are being incredibly brilliant and productive in their 70s and 80s. Yeah, there's a detriment to it. I'm not sure if it's time to take the big step of amending the Constitution, but I'm certainly open to it.
Okay. So let's go to the logistics of your job. Is that all right?
Absolutely.
How does a case appear in front of you?
Well, a couple of different ways. Most of the time, somebody has taken their case to the trial court and lost. And they think that was unfair. Their first step is to appeal, not to my court, but to the Intermediate Court of Appeals. There's one sitting in Seattle, there's one sitting in Tacoma, and there's one sitting in Spokane. And they have an appeal as a matter of right to that Intermediate Court of Appeals, which, by the way, wasn't created until I think the 1970. I could be off by a year or two. And they will be able to take their legal challenge to whatever happened in the trial court below to the Court of Appeals. But they might still think that they were wronged. And if they do still think that they were wronged, then they can ask our court to grant review.
Or the other side could disagree with the Court of Appeals.
Whichever side thinks that they were wrong, you're absolutely right. Whichever side thinks that they were wronged in the Court of Appeals, and occasionally both sides think that they were wronged in the Court of Appeals, they can ask our court for review. Unlike the Court of Appeals, we don't have to take every case that's presented to us. In fact, we can't. We have a list of criteria for cases that we will take. So the Court of Appeals decision is going to be the final decision in the majority of cases. We will take the case where there's a dispute in the courts of appeals on a particular issue. Or there's a dispute between a Court of Appeals decision and a decision of our court. Or there's a question of exceptional importance that should be decided by our court, or there's a conflict with our Constitution or the Constitution of the United States. Basically, we're a court of discretionary review. So we take only the cases that fit our criteria for review when you're seeking review of a Court of Appeals decision. And we end up taking about 10% of the cases that are brought to us, which means that we have to review at least preliminarily 100% of the cases that come to us in order to decide which ones to grant review on. And that's the bulk of the cases that we do. There's a couple of other categories too. There's a small category of cases that come directly to our court and don't stop at the Court of Appeals. For example, death penalty cases can be appealed directly to our court. There's also another category of cases. The federal courts can ask us certified questions. So a federal court can say, you parties have brought this case properly in federal court. It does also raise a question of state law. This is a really tough question of state law, and I don't find any controlling Washington authority on this issue. I could predict what I think the Washington courts are going to do, but given that I'm not a Washington court, I could also defer to the Washington courts by asking them to answer this question. Dear Washington Supreme Court.
I've seen this a couple of times. It's kind of rare. I don't think it happens too often that the federal courts certify a question to the Washington State Supreme Court.
I think we get one or two per term.
Yeah, that sounds about right. Does that annoy you? Do you have it budgeted? Like, the feds are going to be lazy and drop us something in our laps? Or is it like, we can take, 50 cases this term. Oh, 51st case out of nowhere. Come on, guys. Just do your job.
Well, when I first got onto the court, I thought, this is great. This is a question of pure law. The federal court has already identified the issue. I can do what I'm terrific at, which is analyze the law with my background in Washington law, and we can provide a better answer to the question. After being on the court for several years, my view of those cases has changed. We get those cases in a vacuum. We get a pure question of law that's presented to us, and we don't have a trial court record to provide context. And it's really hard.
Is there a briefing?
Oh, there's total briefing. There's briefing from the federal court, which is available to us, and then each of the parties file briefs in our court, which is also available to us. But the briefing is on the legal question that the court has framed. And the federal court will frame it in the context of a particular set of facts. But as you know from reading our decisions in not certified cases, in regular cases, facts are rich. Facts present so much context. Facts allow you to muse over, well, what if this fact was different? What if that fact, how will this impact the next case that's going to come up that has a slightly different set of facts? And I now find that without that full, rich context, it's pretty challenging to answer a question almost in the abstract. And we do, but they've often produced fractured decisions. And for sure, we've produced fractured opinions in other cases. But I think the certified cases present particular challenges to answering them.
Yeah, I think that's something that a lot of non-lawyers don't understand, is that the court's opinions, the Court of Appeals, the Supreme Court, can kind of tweak their focus. They can make it a very narrow answer based on these facts specifically in this situation. This is the answer. Or they can make a broader statement, like going forward, things that fall under this umbrella should be treated like this.
Well, that's what's rich and wonderful about our common law. We have a case that set a general rule about, I don't know, when you can conduct a search, when the police can conduct a search without a warrant. And we have a few very specific exceptions to it.
Jealously guarded exceptions.
Jealously guarded exceptions.
They could be a little more jealously guarded.
Well, then you get a case that is interesting because it's not clear whether it fits within this exception or that exception or no exception at all. Well, it's the facts, the context, that allows you to look at it and decide, where does it fit? Yes, we have this theoretical rule, but it's the facts that make it challenging to say where it fits within the rule. And it's the facts that develop our common law and enable us to say, well, this case is more similar to that case and should be treated this way and is less similar to that case and so shouldn't be lumped into that category. And I find that difficult to do with the certified questions that don't have that rich context.
The fun part for you guys is also the technology. You know, the U.S. Supreme Court has done some stuff with smartphones that has been an advance of basically the laws catching up to what smartphones are these days. And you guys see that stuff all the time, too.
Technology means you're taking new facts, new complex facts, and seeing whether they fit within old doctrines is a search of the cell phone once you've validly grabbed the cell phone, permitted or not permitted. Is that just like plain view, or is that more like prying deeply into a container? Mm-hmm. It's great issues.
Yeah. So you get 10 times the amount of cases, 10 times petitions, the amount of cases you can take. Do your clerks like look through them and weed out the really obvious, this is not going to be accepted by the court, or do you guys look at them individually?
Okay, here's what happens. Let's say you were convicted of something very minor. You've appealed and you lost, and you file a petition for review in our court. That petition for review will go to the clerk, who will docket it, and it will initially go to the commissioner's office. Our commissioner's office, we have a commissioner of the court, Narda Pierce, and her office deals with the bulk of the petitions for review and motions for discretionary review by having the attorneys in her office do a complete review of the petition, any opposition, the file, and then producing a summary memo for the justices. And then once a month, the justices get together in departments, and I'll explain departments in a second. Mm-hmm. And we have about 40 to 50 cases to make decisions on. Should we grant review on this petition for review? Should we grant review on this motion for discretionary review? Should we modify the commissioner's initial decision to deny review in a particular case? And I'll get a notebook on all of those cases, and it'll have the commissioner's memos on the petitions for review. It'll have the commissioner's decisions on the motions for discretionary review. And my clerks will produce, or the justices who sit in each department will produce memos on the cases where the commissioner has already made a ruling, so that she doesn't have to produce a memo about how good her own ruling was.
Okay.
So I'm looking at 40 or 50 cases that have been reviewed and briefed not just by the parties, but are accompanied by a neutral brief from the commissioner's office in certain cases or a justice's clerk in other cases. And what do I do with all of those? Well, as you know, there's 9 justices on the court. It takes 5 votes to do anything. So we sit in departments of 5. I'm in department 1 right now.
The best department?
It is right now. And you can tell which department we're in if you go to an argument or if you look at a photograph of us, even on the website of us listening to argument. You'll see that the Chief Justice is seated in the middle, and she's got 4 justices to her right and 4 justices to her left. And we're ordered in terms of seniority. Well, Department 1 is everybody to her right plus the chief. Department 2 is everybody to her left plus the chief. So the chief sits in both departments, and me, Justice Wiggins, Justice Fairhurst, and Justice Johnson are now sitting in Department 1, and then the chief and the other 4 justices are now sitting in Department 2. So, all of these petitions for review, motions for discretionary review, come to one department or another. motions to modify decisions on motions for discretionary review come to one department or another. Well, if we're all unanimous, all five of us are unanimous to grant, we grant. If we're unanimous to deny, we deny. If we're not unanimous, even if it's 4-1, either way, it goes to the entire court. So you'll either get a grant or deny out of a department, meaning the department had five votes, mm-hmm. or you won't. You'll go to the entire court, and at our monthly conference on cases, there'll be yet another set of memos, and there'll be yet another level of review and discussion. And following that, all nine justices will vote on whether to grant or deny in the case.
Is there, in those kinds of nine justice events, is there kind of horse trading going on? Like if one justice says, I really want to take this case on, I think we can write a really good opinion on these facts, it's a really interesting thing of law. If you have a case you feel strongly about down the road, I'll make sure to vote for that kind of thing?
No, I can tell you that I have never seen horse trading over votes going on.
I'm not talking about the opinion
court.
Itself, just about whether to accept a case.
No, okay. I haven't. There's disputes over whether to accept a case or not, and the disputes might include one justice saying, I agree that the issue is important, but I don't think that this case is the best vehicle for mm-hmm. it. I think we should wait for another case down the line where...
Let's get one more arson and then we can get the right result.
Well,
come on, arson.
Where the issue was preserved, that's mm-hmm. a valid...
Okay.
That's valid. Where the issue was more fully developed, that's valid. Where the issue is not complicated by the other extraneous things, that's valid. I have often heard justices saying, you're right, good issue, not a good vehicle for it. Or potentially good issue, not sure if there's a fully developed conflict among the courts of appeals. Let's wait and see if there is a real conflict in the courts of appeals or whether they sort it out.
That seems really challenging for the litigants, not that they're obviously involved in that process, but that they, you know, if it's a criminal case, someone is facing potentially decades or life in jail, prison, and that things weren't fleshed out or the issue isn't quite ripe for review, and that's they're just not going to get heard. And your adherence to principles of the law and helping guiding the lower courts makes perfect sense, but along the way there's somebody who could really use another set of eyes on their case that just won't get it.
Well, the severity of the penalty might be something that justices consider in determining whether it's an exceptionally important case or whether there's a important conflict with a constitutional principle. So the penalty involved actually might play a role in it. But you're also talking about something that we do see from time to time, which is that an issue wasn't preserved well.
That's all for part one of my interview with Justice McLeod. Tune in next week where we talk about preserving errors, ineffective assistance of counsel, the independence of the judiciary, and lots more. See you then.